I do appreciate when people come and give suggestions for the talk of an evening, simply because that makes it very clear that I'm not just talking from theory and things which aren't relevant to you, but actually talk which is very, very relevant to you because you suggested the topic. And so just before I came in here, someone asked to talk about friendship. So the talk today is about friendship at all the different levels. And it is true that even though, as we used to say in Buddhism, you are born alone and you die alone, it's actually what happens in between is really important. That's called life. And during that life, yeah, you can actually maybe be by yourself a lot of the time, but it really does help to have good friends. And that's actually one of the purposes for coming here over Friday evening. I know that somebody said that this is a very good singles pickup place. And many people have met their partner here. Even Dennis, you met your wife here, Heidi. But not me. I've been coming here for 28 years. And I'm still single. And I'm very happy, thank you. But if you are going to meet a partner in life or a good friend, isn't it really wonderful to have someone who actually thinks like you, who has similar ideas about the meaning of life and what's really important? So that's one of the reasons why, make friends here and even find a partner here. Because what that does, I agree with you, that's a very funny joke. I haven't told the joke yet, kid. Anyway. Oh, the lights are going out. Very good. No, it's okay. It's okay for the camera. Okay. So whatever, being a good friend is something which is really important, because there are times in your life which you really need a good friend, just someone just to share things with, and there's sometimes problems to talk things out. Because when you talk things out with a good friend, it's not that they're going to give you advice or tell you what to do. You always notice that when you're sharing with a friend, you're talking with someone you can trust, it means you're also listening to yourself at the same time. And that's really where most of the understanding comes from. Whenever I have any sort of thing I have to decide, I talk it over with someone, I'm also listening to myself. And when I listen to myself, I think, oh, that's very easy. A lot of times when I ask somebody a question, that's when I find the answer before they've even opened their mouth. It's just because when you express the problem clearly, which you have to do to communicate to another person, you're also communicating it to yourself. So a good friend is sometimes someone who's really good there. They can just listen to you. And again, just support you. Because the meaning of friendship should really be like compassion, number one. Someone who's really kind and trust. You know, which includes reliability. And obviously, sort of honesty. So, you know, with those qualities, someone who's really kind, who's reliable, and who's honest, it's amazing just what a wonderful friend can be. And if you can find such a friend, it means there is somebody there who you can rely upon. And it's really strange that sometimes if you choose a friend in dishonest places, like down the pub or down Burswood Casino, or some of these other places. I mean, can you really trust people who go to those places? You know, just the very nature of those places makes them a bit dodgy people. But this is not the dodgy Buddhist center. People here actually keep precepts. They're kind. At least they are when they're in here. I don't know what they do when they go outside, but at least when they're here, they're kind and they're trustworthy. And it's an amazing thing to have reliability and trust. Someone you can really, really trust. And it brings to mind a story of one of my old school friends. You know, we were in Boy Scout Cubs together. And just still remain friends over all these years. He's not a Buddhist, but he came to visit me in Thailand many years ago. And part of, in those days, you know, 30-something years ago, over in the northeast of Thailand, one of the most beautiful experiences was the morning alms round. We'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning in that place and meditate and chant. And when the sun came up, we'd go on alms round. Well, we took our bowl, we walked to the local village for our rice, our food for the day. And that village, they expected us, and they were part of their day. A few times when we never went, they really missed us. It was just like the milkman coming or whatever. But anyway, we'd always go there every morning. And it was the first time of the day. It was really cool and beautiful. People were waking up. You can see the smoke from the little wood fires coming up from the village. It was a beautiful, serene event to come with the monks as they walked silently through the village for alms round. So I invited my friend, why don't you come with me tomorrow morning? We go on alms round in the village. And he said, look, I don't get up that early. How many people except monks get up, at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning? What time do you get up? I bet it's not that time. Actually, most people don't go to bed till 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning when the monks get up. But anyway, so I said, look, you don't have to worry. I will wake you up tomorrow morning just before alms round, maybe about 5:30 or 6 o'clock. You just sleep in your room and I'll be there tomorrow morning. So that's what I did the following morning. I woke him up, 5 minutes early. You can just put on something. You don't have to get dressed to go for alms round in northeast Thailand. The villagers wear rags, so you can wear rags too. Well, not rags, but, the sort of stuff which people used to wear in those days. So we went on alms round, and on the way back, he was just, we're talking because he was an old friend, and we're talking how wonderful it was to have this experience of being on this ancient 2,500-year tradition of the monks going in the early morning on alms round and coming back again. But he said the most amazing experience was when he went to bed that night. Because he said, I knew that you would be there in the morning to wake me up. I knew, 100%. And he said, that's something which is very uncommon for me living in London. He said, many of people, they promise me things, and they say they will be there. And they make all of these plans that, yes, at that time I will do that for you. And he said, so often they let me down. They're unreliable. But for you, you're a monk, you're a good old friend. I knew you'd be there. And that was such a wonderful feeling for me, going to bed that night with absolute certainty that you would be 100% reliable. And when I heard that, I realized, in our world, how many people can you truly rely on? When they say something, that yes, they will be there, they will actually do it. Now, as a monk, that's part of my training. And I think it's really bad karma. If I say I'm going to do something and I don't, then that means that I feel terrible afterwards. I've broken a promise. I've actually lied. And not just lying, I've actually destroyed someone's faith and your plans. I've confused you. So if ever I make a promise, I don't make promises lightly. I really think about them and make sure I can keep them. And then, okay, yes, I'll do it. If I make that promise, I really try really, really hard to keep it. And that makes you reliable and trustworthy. Wouldn't you like other people to be trustworthy to you? When they say that, yes, they're going to come at a certain time, they actually come. How many tradespeople in Perth, the plumber, the electrician, you're laughing, aren't you? Because that always happens. I was ordering some concrete for our monastery, and it was late, so I rang up the yard in Armidale, not that far away, and I said, where's the truck? It's late. And they said, oh, it's just a few moments ago, it's just left the yard. 15 minutes later, it hadn't turned up, so I rang again. And the guy answered, oh, just a couple of seconds ago, it's just left the yard. That's what you said 15 minutes ago. Oh, you must have got a different guy. Yes, I did, because that's what they always say, doesn't it? The check's in the mail. The truck's just left the yard. It's on its way when they're lying through their teeth. Even I rang up one of our disciples, and their little kid, 6 years of age, answered the phone. I said, can I want to speak to your mummy? She said, she's not here. I said, it's Ajahn Brahm. And she said, mummy, it's Ajahn Brahm. Are you here? Please, you're teaching your kids at a young age to be dishonest. So it's great if you have reliability. And that's like a good friend. And kindness, compassion. Now, I often use that simile of developing a good friend, not just with human beings, but also, most importantly, with you. So I'm now going to go back to the more mystical side of good friendship, being a good friend to yourself. Because if you learn how to have a good friend to yourself, then maybe you'll learn all the tricks to have good friendships with other people. So what do I mean by being a good friend to yourself? Are you a good friend to your body? Or do you look upon your body as your slave? With you, the master and the mistress, always telling your body, come on, get up. We've got to do lots of things this morning. And your poor body just says, no, just give me another few minutes of sleep. You know, I'm tired. No, get out of bed. Do you say to your body, come on, you've got to go and exercise. You've got to go to the gym. Say, oh, not the gym again, please, says the body. No, you've got to come to the gym. Do you tell your body, oh, I can't come to the food fair on Sunday because the food is too much and I'll eat too much? No, your body wants to go to the food fair on Sunday. All that delicious, wonderful food. It just said, please, please, please take me. So if you are a real good friend, don't worry about the cholesterol and the fat and the sugar and all the oil, because this is holy food. I'll bless it all, so the cholesterol will all be benign, the sugar won't give you more diabetes, because it's holy food, and holy food takes away, so you can pick out with a clear conscience. So you've got to be kind to your body. But worst of all, how many times do you really push your body when it really wants to rest? Are you a friend to your body? Or does the body really look at you and think, oh God, not her again? Sometimes that's true. No wonder your body sometimes the only way. Look, this is an old saying, the meaning of death. Death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. It's a bit late by then, isn't it? Death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. Isn't your body often telling you, please slow down, take a break, take a rest? And do you ever listen to your body? A lot of times you don't. Which is why, I read a book some time ago, even like heart attacks. I don't know, hopefully, you know, I'm sure that a few of you had heart attacks here. Maybe, hopefully you never do, but all the signals are given to you many, many times before you get the big one. The body tells you. It's very concerned, but a lot of times, because you don't listen, you have to have the big one before you actually realize that you're not being a friend to your body. You're stressing it out. You're regarding your body as your slave, telling it what to do, exploiting it. So it's a wonderful thing to have friendship to your body. Basically, how would you treat a friend? Would you tell the friend, come on, get up, go to work, come on, work harder, come on, go faster, come on, do more, come on, get more. You can't rest, come on, work harder. I don't treat my monks like that, do I? I don't treat you like that, do I? No, she's a good monk. No, I say, I'll take it easy. That's one of the sayings I have over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and I've said it here and I've said it many places, people are more important than things. It's really more important to have happy people, especially healthy bodies, than having great buildings, beautiful centres, immaculate monasteries, where everything is well organised. People are the most important thing. And here it's like your body. And it's got to last you a long time. This guy, 100 years of age, this is one of the quotes which I remember reading. You know what happens when people get 100? The newspapers interview, at least they used to, in the old days when it was quite uncommon, give us some advice, 100 years of age. Now, what have you learned in all that time? And this guy said, look, my message to other people on my 100th birthday is this. If only I'd have known I was going to live so long, I'd have taken much better care of my body. Because you don't know how long you're going to have to put up with this body. So if you're stuck with somebody, you might as well make friends with them. And if you're stuck with this body, it's about time you made friends with your body. And what does it mean by being a friend? Here's my classic simile of not friendship. And I use this often in my retreats. I use it in the retreat which I taught over in Jhana Grove about a week ago. How not to be a friend. Suppose your so-called friend gives you a call and says, please, let's go to have a cup of coffee. And your friend says, and we will have the cup of coffee in Starbucks. Not McDonald's, not Gloria Jean's, not Dome, Starbucks, because I like Starbucks. I don't care what you like. And we're going to go at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, not 2:30. We're going to sit there for 2 hours, not 1.5 hours, because I want to sit there for 2 hours. We're not going to sit in your favourite table on the veranda. We're going to sit in the corner over there, because it's quieter. I like that place. And also, you're not going to have a cappuccino or a flat white. You're going to have a short black, because I like that too. And with soy milk and not sort of real milk, because that's bad for your health and I look after you, so you have to have soy milk as well. And you can have a muffin, but only a chocolate muffin, because that's what I like, nothing else and no biscuits. So we're going to talk about Buddhism, not Christianity. I know you're a Christian, but we're going to talk about Buddhism because that's what I like to talk about. And we're going to just talk for about a couple of hours, not longer, not shorter, because that's what I want to do. Now, if your friend rang you up like that, what would you say? I'm a bit busy. I've got other things to do. I'm sorry, maybe next week. No one likes to be treated like that. So how do you treat your body? You say, come on, we're going to go to work at 6 o'clock. Come on, we're going to go shopping right now. Come on, you're not going to rest. Come on, you're going to do this. All the day you treat your body like that. No wonder it wants to die to get rid of you. So look, be kind to your body. Now let's change that from a not friend to a real friend. The real friend says, hey, you know, are you free tomorrow afternoon? You say, yeah. And you say, you know, well, do you want a cup of coffee? I said, well, okay. I said, where do you want to go? And I said, I know this really nice coffee shop, you know, just somewhere in Northbridge somewhere. Really? I've never been there before. Yeah, it's really good. Okay, then we'll go to your coffee shop. And when you go there, so what, how long do you want to stay there? Where do you want to sit? What do you want to eat? What do you want to say? What do you want to talk about? If you've got a person like that, you love going with them because they're kind and they're considerate. They're mindful of you. And because of that, sometimes 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours go past, you're having a great time together because you like to hang out with friends who are kind and considerate and sensitive to you. And that's the same if you're kind and a good friend to your body. It means your body likes to hang out with you 80, 90, 100 years, much longer than you really had planned for. Simply because you're being kind and sensitive to the body. So sometimes you're a friend to the body. So you can try this tomorrow morning. It's a weekend, okay? I mean, yeah, you've got things to do. We've all got things to do. I've got things to do as well. But when you wake up in the morning, treat your body like a friend. First thing, good morning, body. How are you today? Like you would treat a friend. And then you say to your body, what do you want to do today, body? Ask it. See what it wants. It's amazing, you know. I love this idea of asking questions of your body, asking questions of your mind. What does it want? Because a lot of time when you ask the questions, you get amazing answers. The body says, I really feel like some exercise. Or I really feel like a rest, another half an hour, because I'm really tired. Or I really need sort of, you know, I want a cup of coffee, or I want a sort of some juice or something. If you ask your body that, a lot of times, the body is thankful. At last, you're paying attention to me, you're sensitive to me, and your body will tell you what it wants. It's amazing, just if you only ask, you'll find out what this body needs. So try that tomorrow morning. Ask your body, what does it want? Be a friend to your body. But not just being a friend to your body. The most important thing to be a friend to is your poor brain. Because you exploit your brain terribly. You know, if there was, I really want to actually to do this, you know, to go to the United Nations and extend the Human Rights Act to make sure that there's no more people abusing their brains. You know, we've got the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children. Now I want the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Brains. And I think many of you would be found guilty. And being so cruel to your brain, making it think so much. You've got a problem. You're not a friend to your brain. You're not a friend to your mind. So that's another thing you can do. Tell your mind, or ask your mind, mind, what do you want to do today? And I've been teaching that on meditation retreats. You get up in the morning, you don't only have to meditate at this time, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. Ask your mind, what do you want to do right now? Have you ever done that, asking your mind what you want? And then you're treating your mind like a friend. When you treat it like a friend, it responds. A lot of times, you all, well, most of you did some meditation before we started. Have you ever found difficulty just being here? Well, has your mind always run off here, run off there? You've got nothing to really do, always thinking about this or worrying about that. Why does it do that? And I realize why it does that, why your mind keeps running away, is because it's scared of you. You've treated your mind so badly in the past. When it comes to meditation and the mind thinks, oh God, here he comes again, the first thing the mind does is either fall asleep or run off into fantasies in the past or future, anything to get away from you because you haven't been friendly to your mind. You haven't been kind to you. So being friendly to the mind, if you have got that beautiful thing, oh, this is my mind, it's not the perfect mind, but it's good enough, then you can hang out with it. What type of people do you like hanging out with? Now you can imagine, what type of people does your mind like hanging out with? And are you one of those people? Are you kind, reliable, gentle, nice, sensitive? If you know that, you can actually learn how to meditate very, very deeply. By just learning how to be kind and friendly to your mind. So a lot of times I've said that to people when they're meditating. You ask your mind what it wants. And mind says, oh, I just really want to think about something. You don't say, oh, stop it, you're not supposed to think. Say, no, off you go, that's fine by me. You're not a control freak. Your mind is not your slave. It's your friend. So it's not this mistress and maid. You're two equals. You and your mind, you and your body. And if you have no idea of superiority, no controller, then you find, yes, you can be kind, you can be friend. And your mind stays with you, it hangs out with you. Of course it hangs out with you, just like I like hanging out with my friends. But if it's someone who's trying to control you, you don't like hanging out with them at all. That's called restlessness. Always trying to find some place to escape, to disappear. Your mind has had a bad time with you before. That's why it tries to run away. So if you are a friend to your mind and a friend to your body, a lot of this stress, restlessness, worry, and even physical sickness disappears. We have this idea that we're in control of our body and control of our mind. And because of that, we become control freaks. Because we were control freaks, our body and mind just, they don't like us anymore. When they don't like us, that's when they play up. So if you are kind to your body, kind to your mind, look at it on a friend, as a friend, not only does your mind get more peaceful, your body gets healthier, you become spiritually and healthily far more advanced. Look, are you this dictator? It's like concentration camp guard on your body and mind, always telling yourself off. Or are you a good friend? And a good example of being a good friend to your mind is a story of saying, well, even if your mind wants to go thinking and do something, let it go. That's what a friend is, it lets it go. But don't worry, it will come back again. I remember telling this story to a counsellor from Singapore who was staying in our monastery some years ago. And it was actually a story from one of the people here in Perth. Because this was a young mother. She had a kid who was about 6 years of age. And this kid, 6 years of age, you know, was getting really fed up with her mummy. And one day, this little six-year-old boy said, Mummy, I don't love you any longer. I want to leave home. A six-year-old wanted to leave home. You know what Mummy did? Mummy said, good idea, darling. I'll help you pack your bags. Did I tell a story? Okay, because I give so many talks. I'm getting old now, so my memories sometimes go, when did I tell this last story? I think it was at the retreat. So, okay. darling, you can leave home. And mummy went to pack the suitcase for her little kid, 6-year-old. So went to the bedroom, got the little kid's suitcase and packed all the important things in life, like the teddy bear, like the PlayStation and other things in a little bag. And mummy said, oh, darling, before you leave, I'll make you something for lunch. So the mummy made a sandwich for a kid. And the kid, carrying the sandwich in one hand and a bag, a suitcase in the left hand, in the other hand, just the mummy kissed her son, 6-year-old, at the front door, and the kid walked to the end of the garden path, opened the door, and just went off into their life. He let the 6-year-old leave home. And of course, you know what the 6-year-old did? He just got about maybe 50 metres past the garden gate when he got homesick, turned around, came through the garden gate, up the garden path, and mummy was still waiting there. Welcome home, darling. Now that's a great psychologist. Of course, a 6-year-old, they're not going to leave home. They're just going to get a little way and they're going to miss their mummy and everything else. But if mummy had said, no, you can't leave home, no, 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 she wouldn't be a friend to her kid. So get okay, off you go. And this Singapore girl, when I was telling that story, she was being very, very disrespectful to me. She was rolling around in front of me, holding her tummy, laughing and crying with laughter. I said, why are you reacting hysterically like that? And she said, you'd never believe the Sajjan Brahm, but the same thing happened to me in Singapore. I was about the same age, and I had an argument with my mummy, and I said, I want to leave home. And mummy did something very similar. We also went into my bedroom, and mummy helped me pack my bag. The only difference was she didn't make me any sandwiches. This was in Singapore. She gave me $20, buy your own lunch. That's what happened. So, and it was also no garden path. They're in one of these block of apartments. So he went to the elevator, the lift, and mummy was outside. Bye-bye, darling. Have a nice life. Don't forget to write. So I went into the elevator and pressed the button, closed the doors, went down to the bottom floor, and by the time I got to the ground floor, I missed my mummy, she said. So she pressed the button for her floor level, and of course the elevator went straight back up, and when the doors opened, the mummy was waiting there. She knew her daughter wouldn't go that far. Welcome home, darling. Now that is wisdom. So by being kind to your body, being kind to your mind, you can let it sort of do this, let it do that. It will come back again. So you're not a control freak. When you're not a control freak, that means you're a friend to your body and to your mind. You don't control it. You learn from it, allow it to be. And that's exactly what you do with your real friends. If you want to control somebody, you'll never have a friend. If they want to go off somewhere without you, okay, off you go. They will come back because you're a good friend. That's one of the worst things about, you know, trying to have a friend is we sometimes possess them and own them. We put them in a cage, we tie them up, and that's, of course, no way to treat a friend. To treat a friend, we let them go. We let them be. And that's the same with a partner in life, with a friend, with a child. Often say that there's two ways you can look after, say, a bird. You've got to have them in a cage because that's where they live if they're a pet in your house. But make sure if you put them in a cage, the cage door is always left open. So they can leave whenever they want. Number two, to make sure that inside the cage there's a beautiful bed and lots of nice food. And if there's lots of nice food and a nice comfortable cage, sure, the bird might fly away, but it will always come back again because it's a nice place to stay. And that's exactly like kids, like friends, like even partners. Don't try and lock them up, because the other way, if you do lock them up in that cage, sooner or later the cage door will be open by chance, and then they'll fly away. They'll never, ever come back. They feel they've escaped. Have you ever been in that sort of relationship or been with people you feel so sort of like being put in a cage, controlled? Of course, that's no relationship, that's no friendship. So the real friendship is a friendship of letting go, freedom, being kind to each other, and being sensitive to one another, treating a person, as I said, like, you know, the simile of the taking a person out to coffee. But it's not just being a friend. If you learn how to be a friend with yourself, you can be friends with so many other people. Again, you've got to be kind to them, that letting them be, and also being reliable and trustworthy. So in other words, if you say something, you can make a promise, please keep it. So sometimes that's what people say. You know, sometimes people say to me, because they keep inviting me all over the place, on Sunday afternoon I'm going to East Malaysia for a week. And they say, when are you going to come back again? Or where are you going next? And I say, well, I can't go tomorrow, but next week, who knows? The future is uncertain. That way I can never actually break any promises. So sometimes you can say that when people ask you, can you come tomorrow? You can say, well, the future's uncertain. Who knows? Because the future is very uncertain. Who knows what's going to happen next? That's one of the great teachings of Buddhism about the uncertainty of what's going to happen next. But if you are kind and trustworthy, it's amazing just how the future will always turn out in a good way, simply because it's a law of karma. The law of karma means if you do nice good acts over right now, if you're kind, let people be, don't control them, be sensitive to them, you know that's good karma now. It must make good karma in the future. So that's why I don't really worry about the future. I worry about the present moment. Make sure this present moment is done very, very well. All the kindness, the gentleness, compassion right now. And I trust that's the best way of looking after the future. And that's actually where friendship comes from. I was going to mention this story. It's sort of related to the idea of friendship, but it came into my mind because it's one of my favorite stories, which I read in a book a long time ago. And it's very, very inspiring. And it was about a young man, I think he was over in New York or United States. And this young man, he was putting himself through college. Even in those days, it cost a lot of money to put yourself through college. And especially he was going through medical school. So during the holidays, the vacation period, he'd get any job he could get, which was the job he got was selling these things from door to door. Now, I remember I did that because I came from a poor home, and when I was, going through university, I got all these jobs, and one of the jobs I got was selling encyclopedias from door to door. I actually did that. Really crazy. But that actually leads to another story, because I was actually selling these encyclopedias from door to door, children's encyclopedias. And the worst thing I did was actually sold one. I sold one to this poor young family. And, you had this way of selling it, basically to make the parents look like they were just one step down from child abusers if they didn't buy this amazing sort of children's encyclopedia. They really work on their guilt. And one day I did the sales pitch so well, I actually sold one. And afterwards, I felt so guilty. I felt these poor parents getting this stupid encyclopedia, which was just a total waste of time, paying over too much money for it. And I was thinking that maybe they won't be able to afford enough food for their kid after they pay off this encyclopedia. And I had all this sort of proliferation of all the bad stuff I did. For years I felt guilty about that, about selling this encyclopedia when I was a kid. I resigned the next day. I couldn't live with myself. I didn't sleep that night. I felt really guilty. I thought I'd done a bad thing, but years and years and years later, here, sitting here in this hall, I told that story about guilt. After the talk, like you do, someone came up to me. I don't know if they're here this evening. They came up to me and they said, "That's a really fascinating story you told, Ajahn Brahm, because when I was a little girl, this student came to our house and sold my mummy and daddy this children's encyclopedia. And that was my favorite book. I loved that encyclopedia. I took it with me all over the place. It was my most favorite book of all." I said, "I don't know if it was you, Ajahn Brahm, but the coincidence is so great. Who knows? It could have been. I thought I'd done something bad, but actually it turned out to be something very beautiful. I just proliferated." But anyway, this guy, I don't know what he was selling. But if you've ever done door-to-door sales, it's really, really, really difficult. Maybe that's actually how I learned how to speak to you guys, when to do it the hard way, first of all. But anyhow, this guy was selling something or other, and it was a really hot day. And so he said he wrote this story. He knocked on one person's house. And of course they didn't want anything, but it was a woman, and she said, young man, so you look really tired. Have you had any lunch yet? And he said, actually, no, I've been just trying to sell things all day. So the woman said, come into my house. I can give you a glass of milk and a cookie. A biscuit, that's what they have in the United States. So, of course, that was really nice. A nice glass of milk and a couple of biscuits. Thank you very much. And he always remembered that, just the kindness of a stranger. And later on, he graduated, became a doctor, and became a specialist in cancer. And he said that one day, sort of, he had this patient who came in, and she was an old woman, and she had this very, very bad cancer, and basically all the other doctors gave up on her. But he said, no, maybe I'll try a bit harder on this one case. And doctors go to all these conferences. He rang up a few people in the field, and he managed to get a team together and give this woman state-of-the-art treatment. And it worked. He managed to get this woman from almost certain death to full remission. And she was so grateful to him, but even more grateful when she got the bill. You know how much this treatment costs in the United States? Hundreds of thousands of dollars. But when she opened up the bill from the doctor, he wrote on it, paid 30 years ago with a glass of milk and two cookies. He never forgot that woman. He knew her name and address. It was that woman who was sick with cancer. When the woman came into his surgery, he said, I remember this name. Check the address, it was her. So he did all this treatment, getting all his friends. He paid for himself, because when he really needed a glass of milk and a couple of cookies, she was there for him. And now he was there for her. A true story, a very beautiful story. So look, if anybody knocks at your door selling you something, please give them a glass of milk. That could be your doctor in 30 years' time. That can save you a fortune. That's what I mean by the law of karma. It actually works. You do a small act of kindness and goodness, and it comes back to you. Now, that's what real friendship really means. Now, being really the small acts of kindness to a person. And it's a small thing for you, but later on you find it's a huge thing. That's what friendship really means. Little acts of kindness and generosity, to other people. Little acts of kindness and generosity to your body. Little acts of kindness and generosity to your mind. And then you have a friend for life. If you understand that, understand the importance of, the friendship and how to make those friends. I know sometimes people say, oh, it's so hard to make friends. And the reason is because they haven't made friends with themselves yet. They're not at ease with themselves. Because they're not at ease with themselves, they always tend to be a bit sort of reserved with other people. They don't open up with other people because they're not opened up with themselves yet. So if you really want to make lots of friends, first of all, be a friend to your body and a friend to your mind. Be a friend to your life, a whole lot of it. Yeah, you haven't had the best of lives. You're not the most perfect of people. You've all done bad and stupid things, like I've done bad and stupid things. Even just recently, we went to a funeral service on Wednesday? Not a funeral service, but some of you were there. It's a Sri Lankan lady who used to come here, who passed away at 96 or just almost 95. And there I was telling the daughter, and I said, no, it's wonderful that, just how your mother died. And she said, it's not me. That's my husband's mother, not me. I made a mistake again, but I said, look, that's what happens when I'm 60 years of age and over. I start to make mistakes, and I told them the story. One of my big mistakes once, I was doing a funeral service in Subiaco, and I was doing the funeral service. Again, it was for an old Sri Lankan lady who passed away, or Sri Lankan, somebody passed away. I knew the children. The children were very good disciples would come here every week, but I never really saw the parents. I think because they were too old and sick, they couldn't come here. So at the funeral service, and I was leading the funeral service, and you know, funeral services are very solemn. And I was, you know, because people were sad, the person had died, so I was being solemn, doing the chanting and giving a few sort of anecdotes. And then I mentioned that, you know, we've come here today to, you know, to celebrate the life of, you know, this couple's mother who just passed away. She's a very good woman and blah, blah, blah. And then this old lady stood up in the middle of my speech. And she said, "It's not me, it's my husband who's died." I knew it was one of their parents. I just, you know, got the wrong one. The father had died, not the. That was one of my favourite funerals. I'm going to write a book one day. My favourite funeral services. Like the one. Oh, she's not here today. Jenny. She often comes and sits in the front. Like her husband who passed away. He was very young. Passed away, and I don't know if you know this, but you can actually make your own coffin. You know, you don't have to buy one off the shelf. You can actually do it yourself. So, you know, she had a sort of a brother or a friend who was a bit of a carpenter. And the both of them, they were really into white water rafting. They'd actually, you know, that was their little company. So they tried to make a little canoe, you know, and actually use that as a coffin. And they couldn't actually make it like it. Well, they tried their best to make it look like a canoe. They had to have a top on it, but they had two oars on the top. The trouble was, it was the right size, but it was made of really thick wood. It was too heavy. And the funeral directors almost had a few more customers when they tried to lift it off the back and carry it. It was so heavy. But they managed to get it onto, this was actually a freemantle, it was the external committal. That's actually where you're all on the outside, and they have this little conveyor belt, and you put it on there, and then you do some chanting, some sort of jiggery-pokery, and then you press. Well, I'm being honest with you. And then you press the button, and then, you know, the screen sort of comes open, and the coffin goes behind the screen, and the screen closes behind. That's, you know, you've been to those funeral services, you've seen them before. And the trouble was that coffin was so heavy that the poor conveyor belt, it couldn't actually manage. It was creaking and trying to actually to pull it through. But then the door, the glass door, that opened in time. That must be on a different motor. And the coffin was only halfway through when the screen slammed against it. Totally jammed. And the poor funeral directors, you know, they look really serious. I've never seen one look so serious. You know, he was freaking out. His worst nightmares. And so he got stuck there. And he couldn't dislodge it. And I'll never forget Jenny. She actually jumped up on the conveyor belt and started pushing. And the other people said, is that how much you're trying to get rid of Steve? And then someone else joked. Actually, you know, he grew up with Steve. And he said, I remember Steve when he was young. The first time he got a car, the first day he had his first car, he crashed it. First day in his coffin, he crashes his coffin. And people really cracked up. And it was the most wonderful funeral service I've ever been to. And I think, if I have a funeral service, that's what I want. It's for everything to go wrong, to make it human, for people to laugh, and to remember me with a smile rather than just with all these tears. It was a great funeral service. That's one of my best. But anyway, how did I get onto that? Oh, yeah, with all these little anecdotes. But anyway, that being a good friend, you know, to yourself, and being a good friend to life as well. So being a good friend means, you know, I'm a Buddhist monk. I've been a Buddhist monk for 37 years now. And it's also, I've been as a Buddhist for about 5 or 6 years before I became a monk. But you know, once I became a monk, I made a very important decision in my life to keep my Christian friends. Because I never wanted to be so narrow-minded that all I ever had was Buddhist friends. You know, because if I just had Buddhist friends, you know, I would get no feedback. I'd just become so narrow. So I made a point of making sure I keep in contact with all my Christian friends So basically, to keep me balanced. Because if you are going to have friends, yeah, now have some close friends who are like you, but also have some friends who aren't like you. I know to this day, a couple of the friends which I really cultivated was good old Abbot Placid from New Norcia Monastery. He was a really, really nice friend. He passed away, it was about a year ago. And look, we were such good friends. This is one of the things which, I was really honoured. I was really, really sort of pleased when I was invited to, I think it was St. Joseph's in Subiaco, for his funeral mass, to give a few words there. And I had the Archbishop Hickey and all these other Catholics. There was only one who was non-Christian, let alone a Buddhist monk, and not just sitting in the back, invited up to the front, to say a few words, because they realised that we were really good friends. It wasn't nice, like a Buddhist monk and a Catholic monk, just really, really good friends. Isn't that something beautiful? Not only that, you've got a good old John Shepherd over at St. George's Cathedral. We went to one of these Buddha birthdays over in Supreme Court Gardens. They usually have one every year. Many of you may have seen that. They have all this big stuff over in the Supreme Court Gardens for Buddha's birthday. And he was there. We were going to go there. And I met him a couple of weeks before. And I said, "Are you going over today?" He said, "I don't know. It might rain." I said, "Look, it certainly won't rain. It doesn't rain on these Buddha ceremonies. At least not mine anyway, but it did on theirs. But, being a bit loose," I said. He said, "I'll bet you a dollar it'll rain." I said, "Okay, you're on." And I lost. I lost a bet. And the trouble was, I'm a Buddhist monk. I don't have any money. And he never let me forget that. Every time I saw him for the next year, he said, "You owe me a dollar." So finally, this is the Dean of St. George's Cathedral, still a good friend. Finally, I managed to go with one of the members of the monastery, and I said, "Get a dollar out of the donation box, because I've got to pay off my debts, my gambling debts." So eventually, I gave the dollar to John Shepherd. I paid off my debts, now I can die with a clean conscience. So these are like good friends, and that's actually how you develop good friends. So have a bit of fun and games, but by having like friends across the different sort of religions, it means that you're having friends who can actually, you don't have to be friends who are the same, and you get much more a richer life with friends who are different than you. So it needs to be cultivated, and how do you cultivate that? Again, trustworthiness, compassion. No way I'm going to try and convert these guys. It would be really good if I did convert John Shepherd, because he actually runs the cathedral. It would be, we can have a much bigger centre for our Buddhists. And we can, much closer into the centre of town. Not St. George's Cathedral, but St. George's Wihara. So if I can convert him, then, we're made. But no, there's no way you're going to... Because if you're trying to convert someone, that's not being friendly, is it? So a friend is respecting the other person and being able to sort of adapt to the differences between someone who's not the same as you, but has still got the qualities of compassion, kindness, friendship, compassion, trustworthiness, and then they can become a really, really good friend. And of course, that way we enrich both of our lives. It's a beautiful thing to have such friends. But again, that friend... Remember that simile of taking a friend to a cup of coffee. You never tell your friend what to do. You never control them. You never actually criticize them, because that's not friendship. A friend is there to support, be kind, be trustworthy. And that becomes a really, really good friend. Now, sometimes even, pointing out your friend's faults, you don't need to do that, because too many other people do that job for them. So if you have a friend, you don't need to tell them all the things they're doing wrong. They hear that all the day, just like you hear that all the day. So a good friend should be somebody who doesn't go around criticizing, who can be someone who supports, loves, respects. And then they do really become a very, very good friend. So if you want to have friends, that's the sort of person you have to be to make yourself an attractive friend, someone who is trustworthy, someone who is kind, someone who is, you know, just not demanding of other people. You just sit down with a person, because there's something about human beings. We always like to sort of be with each other, to spend time with each other. But there's also, say, be a friend to yourself. As a Buddhist monk, yeah, I have great friends, but I spend a lot of time being by myself. And that's because that when I'm by myself, actually, I'm never alone. So my whole life as a Buddhist monk, I've never known solitude. Even once, I spent 6 months without seeing another human being. Down at Serpentine, I did this long retreat, 6 months. You remember that, Dennis? But during that retreat, I wasn't alone. I was with someone. You know who that was? Me. When I woke up in the morning, there I was again. You know, I have got this beautiful relationship to myself. I really am my best friend. So don't ever say a dog is a man's best friend. If that's the only best friend you've got, you're in big trouble. No, you are your own best friend. And that was one of the reasons why I've never felt lonely or in solitude, even when I've never seen anyone for months on end. Literally. Because I was always with my best friend, me. So if you can at least look at yourself and say, ah. And I was teaching this to a few people on the retreat. If you want to be your best friend, and now I'm going to teach it here, put out your two arms. Okay, like this. Bring them in. And hug yourself. That way, you're expressing you're a good friend to yourself. Ah, there I am. You're not so bad, at your brother. At least it's one person who loves you. So that way you can be your own best friend. And that's the best of all. If you can do that to yourself, you know, sincerely, it means, oh, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you're not perfect, but no one is perfect. If you try and get a perfect person as your best friend, you're wasting a lot of time. If you try and get a perfect person for your partner in life, you're wasting your time. So they're good enough. It's wonderful to actually have this beautiful openness and friendship. I'm going to be trustworthy. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be sensitive. And then just like the flower, you'll attract all the other beautiful people to you. So if you hang around this joint long enough, we'll find plenty of friends for you. Because I will change you. All the other monks and nuns who come here and teach will change you and become this beautiful, attractive person. I don't mean sort of in your face. That's a bit too old. That's too late to change that one. But certainly with your heart and your mind, make you beautiful, attractive, so that you do attract good friends, because you know what good friendship truly is. So that's the talk for this evening on friendship. So, any questions about the talk this evening? Yes? Yeah? What time do people start eating on Sunday with our food fair? Usually as soon as people come, then they start eating. And they go to about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's amazing. I only eat once a day. And look how much I put on weight. I don't know. But you guys, you eat morning, sort of, you know, just 11s, you know, 12 o'clock, a bit after lunch as well. You know, sometimes people, I see them here, they come on a Saturday and Sunday, they eat all day. And I come out and do this and do that, they're still out there eating. They never put on weight. I don't know what your secret is. I think what it really is, because when you guys eat, you also talk, so the energy goes in, the energy goes out. It's usually 7 o'clock, so is it 8 o'clock? I don't know what. Oh, just come in the other time. Yeah, that's officially. But, you know, they don't start at 9:30. They've already half sold all their food by 9:30 sometimes. So they just come whenever, you know, 8 o'clock, 9:30, whatever. There'll still be heaps of people there. And it's a really good thing to do, as Dennis keeps on saying. And the most important thing is actually this year raising funds. I mean, a little bit goes to keeping this place going, because this place costs a lot. There's a big painting bill coming up soon. A lot for this place to keep this going. We don't charge any entrance fees here, do we? So it's all for free. You get these amazing teachings. If you went to a psychologist, you'd be charged $300 an hour for this. You know, I just went. I gave this big talk in this big Excel convention centre in London. They flew me all the way to London, you know, and then flew me back again to give, you know, a couple of talks in this big convention. And my brother, you know, he turned up the gate. I was up there having a cup of tea just before the talk, and somebody said, "There's somebody who says he's your brother and niece at the door trying to get in for free." I said, "If they're trying to get in for free, that'll be my brother." And so I said, "Can't you let him in?" I said, "Let's go and check it really is him, first of all." So I went to check, and yeah, you know, it's my brother. I said, "Oh, come on, I come all this way, I'm giving a talk." I said, "Okay, they let him in for free." But I said, why didn't you want to pay to get in? He said, "Do you know how much they're charging?" I think it was about £60 or something. How much is that worth? That's about $100? About $120 to come listen to me just for, it was actually about half an hour. You get twice as much for nothing. So yeah, it's fine because we love this. So you know, if you've got some gratitude there for the Buddhist Society, then come and sort of to the food fair. You have fun. You know, we raise money that way. And you know, all the food which is sold there, the people who cook it, they brought all the ingredients. They've been up for weeks preparing everything, spend the whole day. They do that. They don't get any money at all for it. 100% goes to the Buddhist Society. And this year, most of it will go to the nuns' monastery. We've really been working hard to get equity between the genders. Now, many people keep complaining, where are the nuns in Christianity? Is there equity? Can you have an Archbishop of Canterbury who's a female? Can you have a sort of a rabbi who's a woman, or an ayatollah who's a girl? So it's one thing arguing about it. We're doing it. So we've got a beautiful monastery for Buddhist women to be monks, or nuns, whatever they call it. But they're so popular now, they need some more accommodation. So we're raising funds for accommodation in the big hall. And this is where most of the funds are going to. So if you really do support sort of equity, especially in your religion, by coming here and you like Buddhism, and you say, "Well, we want to sort of have a Buddhism we're proud of," then come and support us tomorrow. Sunday. No, support tomorrow. So I forgot. Because tomorrow, support us tomorrow by fasting. So on Sunday, you can eat twice as much. Thank you for that question.